Look, I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for February 2nd, 2010. We actually cannot take up any bills until 9:15 to meet our 24-hour requirement. Please note for the record that Senator Burdick is excused. And then we're going to go through to the first item on our agenda, organizational meeting, adoption of committee rules. Does committee administrator have a little bit to say about the committee rules?
I do. I can quickly go over them if you want. Let me just highlight the primary change is on rule number 13, which is filing a minority report, and it just is reflective of amendments must be requested within 1 hour following adjournment, and amendments must be delivered to committee staff 1 hour after they have been requester has been notified. Other than that, the rules are the exact same from legislative session.
Okay. Is there a motion to adopt the
Mr. rules? Chairman, I move that we adopt the Senate committee rules as discussed. Issued 2-1-2010.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Farioli. It's been moved that we adopt this, the rules for the committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I have a discussion.
Okay.
So go over that again. Mm-hmm. So just for some reason, a guy like me or Senator Burdick, or some other beloved member of this committee decides that a minority report is due, we have to then essentially run to LC, and that qualifies?
Mm-hmm. Within an hour after we adjourn the meeting.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Just want to make sure that that's noted. Thank you.
Okay. Hearing no objection, motion passes. Could the administrator, well, first of all, let me start off and just go. I'll have the administrator go over basically the February schedule. However, this week, just to let you know, on Thursday we will be doing quite a few executive appointments. We will be having 30 interviews on Thursday. We'll be going to a couple of bills after that. I kind of anticipate that we will not get to the second bill, which is sort of the omnibus elections bill. That has been discussed in the committee before. This is just sort of the cleanup bill on a number of different aspects, but the bill's getting larger. And we are obviously meeting Tuesdays and Thursdays from 8 to 10, and obviously later in the session our meeting schedule may be expanded beyond that. Do you have anything to...
I just would like to point out for the members that we will do three successive meetings of executive appointments starting this Thursday. We have broken them up into about 30 interviews and appearances each day, and we will be providing you the notebooks with all of the resumes and applications later this afternoon so we can begin to look at those. And then we will be having bills also on each of those days. So we'll have full meeting days right now, at least through the 11th.
Okay. There may also be one or two appointments that are still pending, because this is not being treated like it's a normal confirmation time for the Senate, like during the interim where they have specific due dates. So we may get a later filing from the governor. I think Senator Farioli is aware of one that might come for ODFW, but we don't know if that one's going to come forward. The other thing that's out there is, as everybody knows, that's on rules. Every bill that's in rules appears to be alive or dead from the first day of session until the end of session. It's both a benefit and a curse. We are still...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We can determine whether those bills are alive or dead depending on whether or not they're sponsored by a member of the minority or the majority party?
Not necessarily, okay. Senator Ferry.
Actually, I've been hearing from my members that they have been told by their chairs, respectively, that their bills are dead.
Senator Farioli, I do not believe all of those bills are dead, but we should have a discussion.
We shall do.
And Senator Farioli and members of the committee, we are still 6 minutes away.
Mr. Chairman, for the purpose of moving the calendar forward, would you like to have a motion to deem it to be 9:15? You can do that.
Now, the League of Women Voters are out there.
Adjourned for 5 minutes.
Yeah, we will be at ease until 9:15. For February 2nd, 2010. We have two bills up, and they're up at this time for public hearing only. We are going to have no more than 20 minutes on each bill because this committee will have to adjourn by 10 a.m. I will open a public hearing on SB 1014, Ms. Pollock, can you come forward? And while you come forward, can the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1014 allows state board or commissions to meet by telephone or other electronic means, provides that member who participates by phone or other electronic means is not entitled to compensation or reimbursement. It does modify terms of office, compensation, and reimbursement for expenses for members appointed to certain public bodies, and it removes the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives from the Fujin Sister State Committee. There are six amendments in front of you, and I will have another one to distribute here in a moment that Ms. Pollock will go through.
Yeah, Ms. Pollock.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sasha Pollock. I work in Senate President Peter Courtney's office. As Ms. Seiler said, this is a cleanup, consistency, clarification, and modernization bill related to both Senate President and Speaker appointments, as well as executive appointments. This is nothing to do with the Governor's Reset Council. This is everything in this bill and in the amendments I'm about to explain to you, we are hopeful is there's no controversy over, and they will be something simply to bring some consistency to the statutes and eliminate some obsolete statutes. So I'm happy to go through this in as much depth as possible, but I'm happy to do it quickly and answer any questions you have.
Okay.
So the bill, we worked on this bill, our office, with the Speaker's office and Nancy Gostaran in the Executive Appointments Office. We also reached out to a lot of the staff of the committees to ask them if there were specific things in the statutes that they would like changed. A lot of the things we dealt with were clarification of terms. If we had a term that ended and began on the same day, we staggered that by one day. We dealt with a lot of per diem issues. If the statute was silent on per diem, either for public members, but especially for legislative members, which was most often the case, we clarified that, and in all cases, we tried to be consistent with what is currently going on. Ideally, this bill will save the state some money, save folks some time and resources in terms of folks who would serve on these boards and commissions by allowing them to call in or otherwise teleconference in, especially for these monthly or bimonthly meetings of licensing boards and things like that when folks have to travel a long distance. We did want to clarify that if they do call in, they are not entitled to that per diem and compensation since they're not taking the time to travel in for that meeting.
Okay.
I'm happy to go through this as quickly as possible, but
Probably we can just go to questions.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Atkinson?
I had a handful of questions, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
thank you.
That would be fine.
What did you clarify when a member is part of a commission or something? Do they receive per diem or not?
Senator Atkinson, Chair Devlin, it was on a case-by-case basis, and we modeled it after what's currently going on. Some of those, they're voluntary, and some of them are reimbursed for travel. Some are reimbursed for both travel and per diem for public members. So we hope that we kind of codified what's currently going on.
So can you give an example?
I absolutely can. In the there are a few in the bill, and most of these are actually in the -4 amendments. This is mainly dealing with per diem for legislators, and I'm trying to find a good example. The Innovation Council of Oregon, the members of council who are not members of the Legislative Assembly were already acknowledged in statute as to be receiving compensation. We modeled what we put in that per diem should be paid to legislators as well because the statute was silent on what they were paid or not paid. And there are several of those. I can give you a kind of breakout of what that is if you would like it in a different form than what's in the -4.
A comment and a question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me say I'm interested to hear the logic behind the -6s. I'm just curious. But I'll tell you one thing why I'm not going to support the bill right now, and that's this. Right now, we have all these commissions and all these boards, and phone teleconferences are nice, but they're kind of more casual than an in-person meeting. And I really hate to endorse that is the better way to do it rather than an in-person meeting, because I don't think as a guy who does conference calls professionally, because of where I live, I don't think it's always the best, an in-person meeting, and I hate to see us stamp as policy that that's good. The second problem is that I think it's a real, and I know this isn't where you're coming from, but as from a 30,000-foot view, I think it's really bad upon the Oregon State Senate to devalue the time that members put into committees by not compensating them for their time. So, for instance, if you live in the Willamette Valley and you come to a legislative meeting, it's very convenient. If you live outside of the Willamette Valley, the per diem doesn't cover your time, it doesn't cover gas, it doesn't cover whatever. But most of us who don't live in the Willamette Valley still make the time to do the meeting because it's our job and that's what we do. And so, I mean, it's important and we're not here to make money. But the policy here says to a potential person serving on a committee that your time is of no value. And I don't like that. And so that's, I would rather see us be even the other way, saying that your time is valuable, even though the job doesn't pay for your gas bill to drive up here. But that's just, you know, I realize I'm coming from the other pendulum of that, but I'm really worried about the precedent that this sets for members and for the institution of the Senate who do not live here in the Valley.
Senator Atkinson, Chair Devlin, let me clarify. The allowance of teleconferencing by no means cancels any of these meetings, and everyone who serves on those commissions would still be absolutely allowed to continue with what they're currently doing in that driving to Salem or wherever the meeting is being held and reimbursed in the exact same way that they're currently being reimbursed. And the clarifications in the dash fours were, it was our intention not to change anything that's currently happening in terms of reimbursement for travel for public members, reimbursement for expenses for public members, and per diem either for public members or for members of the legislature that serve on those commissions. So it was not our intention to take any of that money away from those members. I'm happy to talk to the Dash 6s as well because those deal with something else.
No, that's fine. I mean, Mr. Chair, I know that's not the intent, but the problem is that we're devaluing, as an institution, we're devaluing the commitment that people make. And I just don't like that.
Anything else?
No, sir. Uh-huh.
Not to just react to Senator Atkinson, but just to put this on the record, my understanding of current practice, having members that have had to attend meetings remotely, is that current practice is that they actually do not and actually cannot actually file for per diem unless they physically are at the meeting. That's my current understanding of what the practices are with legislative admin, and that's true.
Chair Devlin, yes, and in fact, one of the reasons that this bill is coming forward is because there's nowhere in statute that actually explicitly states that teleconferencing is an acceptable way for those members of licensing commissions to be present at those meetings, and we wanted to make sure that that was an acceptable.
Additional questions at this time. Senator Metzger.
Just a real brief, dovetailing on Senator Atkinson, I'm just curious, as terms of you talked about the consistency, and I just had a question about that. Like, if you're on the Oregon Global Warming Commission, legislative members, they're not entitled. But if you're on the Business Development Committee, you are. If you're on another commission, you aren't. Another one, you are. Why isn't it all the same?
Senator Metzger, Chair Devlin, that's a great question. All of those commissions were established by the legislature, and at some point in when they were being established, a decision was made whether or not those members were to be compensated. It probably dealt with whether or not they could have a fiscal impact statement, and at this point, our office did not want to change legislative intent that was currently in statute. We just wanted to clarify where there was no statutory language regarding per diem. That's a larger question that we didn't want to put forward in this short session.
Okay.
Just a comment, Ms. Pollock. I just wanted to say that appreciate that the Speaker and the President put this bill forward, but I know the work that you have done on this bill. And as a person who has looked at the literally unbelievable number of commissions and advisory boards and regulatory boards that we have, and trying to look at, trying to find some sense within all of them of commonality in terms of how people are treated that are on those boards or how they actually work on those boards, I think is something that's probably long overdue. This might be a good first step. There are probably some other issues that need to be addressed, but I think it's actually a very good first step. The one thing that I would comment on is that it does seem to be that every session we seem to create 2 to 3, 4, or 5 more of these. We commonly think that it's a good thing to put 2 to 3 members from both chambers on both of these. I have actually been part of some of those. And one of the things that I think is sometimes we should think more about is liaisons to those groups rather than members, because it is quite embarrassing to be the only member out of 4 that I have ever seen at some of those, actually. Because I think members are very busy, they have other responsibilities, and we're getting quite a few just assignments just to get people assigned to things, because 10 years ago somebody decided that there should be 3 legislators or 4 legislators on something, and we should be reviewing that, whether we still need that. Any additional? Do I have anyone signed up?
Chair Devlin, really quickly, I just wanted to draw your attention to the dash sixes. I wanted to make sure you guys know what's in there. It's the elimination of 3 inactive boards and commissions. They include the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, which was defunded. To be clear, this is not the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, which is still active. This is a subset of that. And then the Columbia River Task Force, which is not active, and the Healthy Streams Partnership, which has been combined into a different task force.
Okay. Anything additional?
Yes. On those 3, thank you for the clarification. All 3 of those were in statute?
Yes.
And did they end because they fulfilled the end of their mission?
Senator Atkinson, Chair Devlin, I think it was different for all 3 of them. One was defunded, one was combined into another one, and I think one also finished its mission. Yes.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you for that.
Okay. Anything additional? Seeing nothing additional, thank you very much for being here today. I will close the public hearing, and we will bring this bill back at a future date. I'm now going to open a public hearing on SB 1014. Could the 1028... Oh, I see. Okay, it's just written that way. Okay, I will open a public hearing on SB 1028. We have quite a number of people that have signed up to testify. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview? And Senator Shields, do you want to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1028 requires Department of Corrections to obtain residency information for all inmates for purposes of legislative and congressional redistricting, requires the Department to provide the information to the Legislative Assembly and Secretary of State by January 1 of the next following year, following the federal census, and directs the Legislative Assembly or the Secretary of State, as applicable, to adjust the Census Bureau data to reflect permanent resident status of inmates prior to reapportionment for congressional and legislative districts in the state.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon Senate District 22. I appreciate you having a hearing on this important topic. And the topic addresses what I believe is an unintended consequence of some of the growth in our incarceration population. To me, it's a question of fairness, understanding the fundamental question of where is home? Where does one person reside? Where is their residency? And I think it's an important question for minority communities, and that's why the Urban League is here to testify in support of the bill, as well as the African American Chamber of Commerce. And the question is, how do we ensure that particular communities don't have their votes and their representation diluted? And also, how do we account for the fact that if the way the current system is set up now is that if you happen to live near a prison, in a very real sense, you end up getting super representation by that. And I say that as somebody who has a prison in my own district, Columbia River Correctional Institution, and if something like this did go forward, I would lose 500 to 600 people from my district. But for me, it's a basic question of fairness. And as we go to begin this discussion, I wanted to put a couple of facts on the record. One is that 95% of all inmates will be getting out someday. And because of a bill that was passed in this chamber in years past, inmates who are released are required to return to the county where they were convicted and for their offense. The average inmate in Oregon, another fact, is an average inmate in Oregon is only incarcerated for about 3 years. And despite movies like Bonnie and Clyde, where you see offenders roaming across the country on crime sprees, the literature shows that inmates tend to reside and stay and commit their crimes in one particular area. And all that is important because I think when you're trying to get to the question of where is home, who is most appropriate to represent these persons, I think that it makes sense to me. And I think on the question of basic fairness in the previous session, it made sense to Representative Freeman, Representative Bruin, that people should be counted where they're from, not where they're incarcerated. I have a page just so that you can see where most of the inmates come, and to put on the record, 27% from Multnomah County, 14% from the Marion County area, 8% from the Lane County area, and then about 6% from Medford and the surrounding area. And I'll give this to staff to pass around to you. So that is the question that I'm putting before us, and what this bill does is simply say that the census will do their count. And then for the purposes of redistricting and reapportionment only, this doesn't have anything to do with the dollars that might flow based on population count. And the League of Cities has asked me to put an amendment into this bill that would expressly state that. And I consider that a friendly amendment and would be supportive of that if we decide to move to a work session and get this drawn up. I guess that's the sense of it, is that this is not about money. And the other thing is that I don't think this is going to be a game changer for in a partisan way, one way or the other. But it's a discussion that we haven't had to have before when we only incarcerated 5,000 people in the past. But we're now up to about 14,000. And in another 10 years, that could be at 25,000. And the final fact I would leave you with is that the inmate population is growing considerably faster than the general population. So we might as well get in front of this issue now, Mr. Chair. And if I could, now might be a good time to bring on Peter Wagner by phone from the Prison Policy Institute. And as we're calling him up, I'd be happy to introduce him if you would like.
What about questions, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Farrelly.
Senator Shields and I had a lively discussion yesterday about the bill, and I'd like to put some concerns on the record, and then perhaps the subsequent speakers could deal with those questions.
Senator Farrelly, I think that would be a good idea, and it would give us some time to get everything else set up.
Sure, not a problem. I think the symbol for that, Mr. Chair, is brought out. In my district, which is 34,000 square miles, let that sink in for a minute. All are part of 12 counties. There are at least three facilities, Deer Ridge in Jefferson County, Snake River Correctional Institution in Malheur County, and Powder River Correctional Institute in Baker County. And you might imagine some of those communities were divided in their opinion about whether or not they wanted to have a correctional institution located in their community. And the discussion that attended that question had a lot to do with what resources and assets will come to the community as a result of siting a prison in our community. I'm sure it's a question every community deals with at some point in time. One of those, I think, had to do with reapportionment of resources. And so I want to ask for the record, do you believe, Senator, that that changing the concept of residence back to the community of origin will cause a change in the flow of either federal or state dollars to communities?
No. In fact, I would like to put on the record that that is not the intention of this bill, and this bill will not do that.
And, Mr. Chairman, since this is the capital of unintended consequences, I'd like somebody from Legislative Fiscal to verify that there won't be a change in the flow of funding to communities, because a lot of that is population-based, and in ways that people, you know, don't readily comprehend sometimes. For instance, revenue from Oregon Liquor Control Commission sales are apportioned by population. Mm-hmm. Cigarette tax, same thing. A whole bunch of other resources are distributed based on population. And I'm pretty certain that communities were told that resources would come with these facilities that were population-based. I know that the kids that are incarcerated in the Oregon Youth Authority facilities in Burns count in the school districts, and they are, in fact, receiving services from the ESD and the school district in those institutions. And I would hate to see that community burdened with the obligation to provide the education, but have the kids counted in the districts where they originated. Mm-hmm. And that would be a real problem. So I want to make sure that somebody from Legislative Fiscal provides an analysis that shows that we are not moving dollars.
I would have no objection.
Senator Farioli, are you complete? I will actually ask that the committee administrator at least get the first portion of that, the Legislative Council question asked.
Mr. Chairman, I'll ask further questions later at your convenience.
Okay.
And we have Mr. Wagner on the phone.
Mr. Chair, could I read an introduction of Mr. Wagner? Peter Wagner is an attorney and executive director of the nonprofit, nonpartisan Prison Policy Initiative based in Massachusetts. Since 2000, he has led an interdisciplinary project to protect our democracy from the Census Bureau's practices of counting the nation's mostly urban prisoners as residents of the often remote communities in which they're incarcerated. The New York Times editorial board has written 11 editorials supporting his efforts to change the way prisoners are counted, and the Boston Globe identified him as the, quote, leading public critic of the prisoner count. He has presented his research at national and international conferences and meetings, including a Census Bureau symposium, a meeting of the national academies, and at congressional and state legislative hearings.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Mr. Wagner, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Even though Senator Shields introduced you, just sort of the record, can you state your name?
Sure, my name is Peter Wagner.
Okay, and can you give your testimony over about the next 3 to 4 minutes? I still have about 5 people here waiting to testify, and I have to end by before 10 o'clock.
Understood. Thank you very much for having me here today. If I can, just very briefly, I'd like to share some of my experience about some of the technical and legal questions around adjusting the census. I hope that can help you, and then I'll stop as soon as I can so that I can answer any questions you may have and other people can speak. And this issue matters now for 3 reasons. Where people are in prison are counted matters for 3 reasons, 2 of which are very new problems. One is that there's a lot of people in prison, far more than there were just 3 decades ago. There's now enough people in prison to affect redistricting.
Senator Perry.
Second, since the 1960s, the Supreme Court requires state and local legislative districts to be based on population. And third, the Oregon State Constitution declares that incarceration does not change a prisoner's residence. So in short, the Census Bureau counts people in prison as residents of the facility. Supreme Court requires you to draw equally sized districts based on where people reside. And then you have a state constitutional clause that for the last 100 years has explicitly defined residents in a way that's different from what the Census Bureau does. And surprisingly, this to some folks, and was surprising to me at first, is that states are not required to use the federal census. We can talk about that some more, but I'd like to draw your attention to a more subtle, but I think even more important part of Senate Bill 1028. Much of the attention around this bill has been focused on the impact on state legislative redistricting, But I believe the largest impact could actually be on local redistricting. The districts are physically smaller in local government, and a single prison can have a huge impact. And this bill would empower the local governments to use the adjusted data. For example, in the city of Pendleton, unless corrective action is taken, in 2011, they'll be drawing a city council district that's 28% prisoners. Every three residents who live next to the prison will have as much say over the future of that city as four residents anywhere else. There's a similar problem that's on the horizon in Salem, where there's two wards right now that are about 12% prisoners. So the Supreme Court has set the allowable population deviation for how unequal a district can be at about 5%. And here we have districts that have a larger deviation for a clearly illegitimate reason, I would argue, that that's more than twice as large. So in my view, there's no doubt that Senate Bill 1028 would change how state legislative districts are drawn, but the largest impact could be to empower the cities that contain prisons to draw fairer districts. So I'll stop there in case I can help with any specific technical or legal questions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Wagner?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think Mr. Wagner is exactly the right person to ask this question. This is Senator Ferrioli speaking. I am.
Nice to meet you.
I represent District 30. It's all or part of 12 counties. It's 34,000 square miles. In that district, there are at least four facilities: Deer Ridge, the Snake River Correctional Institute, Powder River Correctional Institute, and an Oregon Youth Authority facility. If those incarcerated inmates are counted in the districts from which they originate, that shifts population out of District 30 and probably into more urban areas, and that would require an expansion of the geographic borders of the district to be apportioned fairly, not by size, but by population. So it's conceivable to me that the district that I represent could swell to 40,000 square miles.
I don't know specifically which direction your district would go in. That's, you know, very hard to predict. But it would definitely be true that if your district was not did not include non-resident prisoners right now, that population would have to be made up and that you would have to add some additional geographic territory. But the basic principle is that districts should be based on people. And under the Oregon State Constitution, the people who are incarcerated in your districts are not residents of it. In fact, if prisoners could vote in Oregon, which they can't, but if they could, they would have to vote absentee in a different district.
Mr. Chairman, I think the argument is a very interesting argument. It deserves consideration. But the net effect, at least in some of the more rural districts, would be to render representation by the citizens of that district grossly unfair in terms of what a legislator can accomplish and what the legislator is expected to do in terms of appearing in local communities and being accessible to constituents. It's a relatively easy matter, and I say relatively because none of this is easy. It's a relatively easy matter for most legislators in Oregon to be accessible to their constituents. It is a relatively very difficult matter when the size of the district is 34,000 square miles and yet has more incorporated cities and special districts than any other because of the geographic size. Making that district larger may be an adjustment that some people see as a fair adjustment and a necessary adjustment, but I think other people would say that simply increases disequity. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We probably need to move on. Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner, for appearing.
Do you want to stay on the phone?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to call up two and then three people. Sid Gower. The representative from the Department of Corrections. And Mr. Winkles. Now, if you could please limit yourself to 2 to 3 minutes each. I still have three more people to testify after you.
Okay.
Please begin.
Chair Devlin and members of the Rules Committee, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to discuss the effects of Senate Bill 1028 with you today.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'd like to welcome Lieutenant Gower back to the facility. He was our top cop for a while and was very ably serving the body.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're not going to ask about your current charges compared to your former charges in this facility.
That's correct. Section 2, subsection C of the bill defines permanent residence as a fixed place of abode or fixed domicile in the department facility where the inmate resides before being placed into custody, which for us would be easy to obtain that information at our intake process. However, right now, the address that we do capture is the one that we try to establish for the release of the inmates to go into post-prison supervision. With that being said, in reference to the initial deadlines for obtaining this data for the this next 10-year census, being January 1st of 2011, we estimate that we would have to go back to our stock population, which would be about 12,600 inmates. Right now, presently, we have 14,000. There are some exemptions in reference to the ones that wouldn't be counted. In tallying, that would be our death row inmates, life without the inmates on ICE detainers, and folks that are not in our physical custody, kind of like the OIA individual as well as the interstate compacts. For us to obtain that information from our stock population, we believe we'd have to hire some temporary employees to help us facilitate that information. The information isn't easily obtained because, like I said, the address that we focus on is the one for release, and the other addresses that we obtain are in text form and data banks that are not easily accessible. So we would have to go back, and these folks would have to access our data banks. They need to have some special access code privileges to access DMV as well as police records and such forth to find that information. The second piece, our aging inmate corrections inmate services program is a little antiquated. We'd have to divert some of our internal resources to make a change if we were going to add that as a provision to get the residents as required. Just to give an example of kind of sometimes how convoluted this could be, if an inmate, if a subject is living in Marion County and goes down to Linn County and commits a crime and then moves to Marion County, the actual address that we would be using would be the one that he was using in Marion County when he committed the crime. So that would be one of the examples. And like I said earlier, the admissions, the process that we would have to go through is debriefing the inmate in reference to addresses and then going back to DMV records, police reports, and databases like that. I'd like to apologize to Senator Shields because in reference to some misinformation he was provided by the department reference last year when he did submit this bill. The amendments he made have made it easier, would make it easier to obtain this information. The address information that he received from us was significantly lower than the 12,000 population, stock population inmates that we feel that we would have to go back to get the information correctly. The information provided to him over a year ago is that the information would need to research was probably about 4,500 inmates. So I apologize for that inconvenience.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Winkles, you're here every day. Could you be relatively short?
Certainly. For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I wanted to we do have some concerns with this legislation. We have identified a potential risk to state shared revenues and other sources of income. Mm-hmm. We have a conceptual amendment into Senator Shields' office that should address our concerns. But to put some perspective on this, the inmate population in the city of Pendleton alone represents $96,000 in revenue to that community. And because a person is incarcerated doesn't mean there isn't a cost to the city. Police, fire, infrastructure needs still need to be met to serve that population. So with that, I'll close.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both for being here today. I'm now going to call up Mr. Marcus Mundy, Ms. Janice Thompson, and Juanita Walton. And if you each could have about 2 to 3 minutes each.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and Senators. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you this morning. I'm Marcus Mundy. I'm president and CEO of the Urban League of Portland. We're based in Portland. And our recent report, the State of Black Oregon, recently published that we sent to every senator and every legislator, as a matter of fact, so I hope you found it interesting reading, and if you've been too busy, I hope you can go back to read it. We have a section on social justice, and, as a matter of fact, and administration of justice, but it confirms that disparities in African-American communities persist in areas of employment, housing, supports for community-based service providers. And one of the reasons these communities continue to be shortchanged is the undercounting in the census. And while this has been well documented, it's important for this body to acknowledge. My own national president, Mark Morial, is co-chair of the Complete Count Census Committee, and we're very keen at the Urban League to making sure we get the count right. Every census undercounts African Americans, Hispanics, and other folks of color. The last census, it's estimated that 4.5 million were undercounted. And 1.3 million of the majority were double counted, which is a separate issue, but that's something that we're wrangling with and trying to get right this time. For our own part, we're involved in the Complete Count Committee with our own county and city groups. And most counties shown by the census that have the fastest growing African-American population are counties with prisons with large incarcerated black populations. In Oregon, our research shows that 10% of the Oregon prison population is African-American, and this is consistent with the national stat that 12% of black men in their 20s or early 30s are incarcerated. While a national figure, we match that well in Oregon. That's a double whammy to people. There's a disproportionate level of incarceration for African Americans, and the communities they leave behind, as was referenced earlier, are shortchanged, even though Senator Shields, I agree, his point is not the allocation of resources, but that's one thing that we notice, that they're shortchanged in money and representation. Dollars do get allocated differently based on population. And I did have a brief, albeit uninformed, response to Senator Ferrioli's comment. I understand that many resources are not directly provided to inmates, but many are, the fire, the infrastructure, and that sort of thing. But I would imagine that when those communities were considering having a prison in their population, one of the largest outcomes of that would be jobs. I know there's a lot of people working in those communities relative to that institution being there, and jobs are the biggest influx of funds generally that you can get. You might have a Google here in the Dalles and a call center there somewhere else, but a prison is a pretty steady revenue stream for a community that's lost timber, that's lost other sources of income. So I would balance some of the benefits to the jobs piece, and they're very instrumental cogs in those communities. But the last thing I'll say is that the Urban League supports counting people where they come from. The state-level census collects home addresses of people in prison and then adjusts the U.S. census counts prior to redistricting based on how other states count students or the military. There's ways that you can, I think, properly allocate people where they came from. So having an accurate count will help ensure the fair and appropriate allocation of the state's precious resources. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Walton.
Thank you. I will first thank you, Mr. Chairman, for letting me speak, and members of the committee. I'll also say that I forgot to bring my glasses, wrote my statement up last night. Okay, I am Juanita Head Walton, representing the African American Chamber of Commerce with 940 members and associates, as well as representative of the Alliance of Minority Chambers, which is a nonprofit organization inclusive of nearly every ethnic minority business and professional group within the state of Oregon and Southwest. I am here in support of Senate Bill 1028. Every week, the African American Chamber of Commerce receives letters from inmates asking for their assistance and legal help. We know minorities are disproportionately represented in our prison systems, and when inmates are counted where they are incarcerated, the area that they came from will lose state and federal funds. Our prisons serve as economic development in our rural areas. These inmates associate their residence in the cities that they came from before being incarcerated. As a former legislator, I would receive mail and telephone calls from inmates and their families asking me for assistance while the inmate is incarcerated. Before serving them, I would first establish a residency of the family or someone. Legislators that are serving inmates that are originally domiciled in their districts are overtaxed and with servicing these inmates and their families. This is a form of representation without being funded into further districts. In fact, I had a colleague who was the chairman of corrections and served in a rural area and had a prison. And her concern, she was servicing the employees and dealing with their issues in terms of state issues. I was dealing with other issues in terms of inmates. The government funds cities based upon the census, and we all know that. And the country has put up with too much prison gerrymandering for too long. And I did want to speak to Senator Ferrioli in reference to his statement in terms of funding for education. I was also a former board member for the city of St. Louis and sat on education in our state. And I'm not sure, but in Missouri, money for students went with the student. So in other words, it didn't matter where they reside, what was important, where they went to school. So if they're located in the prison, that district or whoever's educating them will get those that money.
Janice Thompson with Common Cause Oregon. When I was here before, with Democracy Reform Oregon, Common Cause has reopened an office here and continuing the work. So our organizational emphasis is the same, an interest in accountability, inclusiveness in politics and government. So just three quick points, and it's in terms of being very pleased to kind of testify again in support of this concept. One, again, it's I think organizationally we see it as an issue of fairness, and you've heard many different ways to kind of talk about that. I guess how I would put it is don't count people where they can't vote in the context, certainly, of redistricting. We'd want to emphasize there is a significant local government angle, as Peter Wagner testified. And one point there just is that other states have allowed local governments to make these kinds of adjustments. So just know that there's that precedent. Sometimes it takes the form of not counting prisoners when drawing, you know, the city or county lines. And then finally, we just identify that there is Oregon precedent in discretion of use of census data in redistricting. There was a case decided by the Oregon Supreme Court that indicated that the constitutional reference to census pertains just to the timing of the apportionment process, and not to what data needs to be used. And in fact, ruled unconstitutional one element of the 2001 redistricting that failed to correct some inaccurate census data. So this whole concept of not necessarily using the census data, you know, exactly as it comes is evident elsewhere, but also there's some precedent here in Oregon.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think I've already made the point, but I just wanted to talk about the physical challenges. The District 30 is populations is the same exact population as my colleague from Hood River or my colleague from Portland area. The district is 34,000 square miles. That population average is out to 0.28 persons per square mile. So, you know, under the proposal before us, if we moved several thousand people out of the district, certainly the district would have to get bigger by several thousand square miles. It just seems to me to be, you know, a built-in difficulty in equity in terms of representation. Just maintaining communications over that size of a district and being physically available to folks, even with all the modern conveniences of telecommunications and electronic connections, it's just real hard to do. And so I would just, not to be argumentative, I would just put that counterpoint against your strong argument about counting people from where they originated.
Anyone would like to respond, please respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say not necessarily, because you might be able to pick up a large number of people from a particular area, maybe not in terms of redistricting. But I also wanted to address the issue in reference to the fire departments and police department. You have universities, hospitals that are nonprofit, and they don't pay money or taxes necessarily toward police and fire departments.
Any additional comments? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes.
I have one quick question for Senator Shields.
Shields, if you'd come forward. Again, thank you very much for appearing here today. Senator Shields, very much appreciate you staying around.
Just need your expertise, Senator, on a question after listening to this. Under the current system, is every inmate in our facilities counted as a resident under our current system? As they're counted at the facility, is every every inmate counted as a resident of that area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes. My understanding is that at a particular point in time, the census tries to take a snapshot of where everybody is. So they will do the prison population count. They actually hire consultants to help do that, and they're accounted where they're incarcerated.
All right, so here's the question I have, and you're talking about growing districts, shrinking districts, whatever. We have a pretty sizable population of people who are illegal in this country. In those, so are they counted as residents then? And if this goes back to, and if under this legislation, this is just academic, it's not, yes or no or good or bad, to their place of origin, then actually you would lose residence because they would not be a resident of the United States at all. And therefore, that number, wherever that was currently attributed, would be actually, it would decline the number of individuals. My understanding of that would be correct, because they would not be a resident anywhere in the United States.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's a very good question. This bill, I think, in the way that we defined resident, would say that that undocumented person would still be counted in the institution where they're located.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Senator Shields.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the conversation.
You're quite welcome. For everyone that's here, this is simply a public hearing. This bill may come up later again in the process. I appreciate all the testimony. Sometimes the chair has to be doing three things at once. So I'm still trying to listen to all the testimony. But this is actually one of the first actual real discussions that we've had in this committee related to redistricting. So we will be discussing that issue for quite a long time, I believe. But anyway, I'd like to thank you all for being here, and with that, our meeting for today concludes.